My name is Michael Coates, and I'm the co-founder of two veteran-owned organisations. And these conversations are dedicated to supporting the crosshair where business meets the military. This episode is the one we talk about transition. Brian Wood is the recipient of a Military Cross. He's an inspirational speaker and a Sunday Times best-selling author. We talk values, surrounding yourself with mentors, and the importance of hard work and self-discipline. This is part of the Declassified Network, and this is Forces Friendly. Why did you initially leave?
Because I couldn't carry on doing what I was doing when I found out about my pension.
Go on.
So I had a gap year in 2005. I just needed some time away. I joined when I was 16, 9 months. I'd never been on Civvy Street, didn't really understand it. So I always had that in the back of my mind. What's it like? And after my first tour in Iraq in 2004, I just kind of needed a break for myself and for my headspace, really. And also because I wanted to find out what was actually in the real world.
Mm.
So, yeah, I left. But that year then came to haunt me many years later. So what it was, I was on the original 75 pension scheme. And then there was, I think, a 2005 new scheme.
Mm.
And then a 2015. So there was three different kind of pension schemes. So, you know, I'm fast forwarding now. When I was still serving, I was a CQMS, company quartermaster sergeant. And I thought to myself, I need to figure out what pension I'm on or where it is, because you start to think about it later on, then, you know, 17 years, you start thinking about my pension. And then I phoned up Glasgow. They said, no, you need to write me a letter. So I wrote a letter to Glasgow saying, look, can you break down my pension for me? And about 2 weeks later, a letter was sent to me saying, I'm not entitled to any gratuity or an immediate pension until I'm 65. And I couldn't get my head around it, really. I thought, nah, that's not right. I've had a year off, I get it. But, you know, so did my dad. And so did a lot of other people I knew had whether it be 6 months or maybe 2 years out. But at that time, things had changed and new policies were brought in. And I was subject to that. So I took it to the CO and said, look, is this true? He then spoke to Brigade. Brigade said, yeah, that's a new policy. So I said to my CO, Colonel Flay at the time, I'm going. And he said, no, you can't go. You're just about to come off the board and pick up a fighting company, one of the rifle companies, as sergeant major. Look, just stay. And I was like, what would you do? And he said, yeah, I would probably also leave.
Mm.
There was no incentive for me anymore. I mean, I'd punched the ground just as hard as anyone else. And I wasn't going to get my rewards for my 22 or 24 year service. So yeah, I took
because what you done 90? Did you join 98?
Mm.
98. So you done
97? I joined.
All right, 97. So you done what's that then? 7 or 8 years. Then got out for a year.
Yeah.
Was it 12 months or was it more?
Just over.
Right, it was 12 months. Then you're back in 2006.
Yeah.
And then that's 9 years after that.
Yeah.
Was that ever a discussion then? That break.
Well, when I went in back into the careers office, because I had to go through that process again, but no one picked it up. No one was aware of it. Because if I had found out about it then, I wouldn't have re-enlisted. I would have just carried on, you know, doing what I was doing on the outside. But I had unfinished business. I wanted to go back in, but no one brung this to light. No one brung this to life. So I was not aware of it until that day down my store that I started to make some inquiries and found out myself.
And you'd have stayed in, would you? If they'd have come back and said, no, we'll carry it on. You know, they'll take the year out, but we'll carry it. We'll keep it going with the pension.
Nothing would have changed. I would have picked up B Company as a sergeant major, and God knows where I would have been now. But that's hindsight, and everything happens for a reason. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it does. And, you know, I've had some great experiences without the military.
Mm.
So,
Was it an easy transition then? When you got out, 2015, did you find it easier? Or like when you signed off that year, because obviously for those that don't know, most will, but there's a 12-month signing off period. You sign off, then you get out a year later. Was that 12 months easier for you? Because you'd gone through it already.
Yeah, I mean, it's never easy. It's never. I was a lot older. I was more educated as well, more experienced. And I also had a house, which is a huge thing for me. If I didn't have a house, I might have delayed it, but I had a house in the UK because I was serving in Germany at this point. And that was a massive backstop for me. Huge. So I kind of served notice on my tenants and kind of linked it in to where I was withdrawn from my married quarter in Germany back into the UK. And then I had a kind of quite a lot of leave to use to do my resettlement or go on courses. And yeah, I used that back in the UK. But I mean, stepping away from... And the military is an incredible organisation, regardless of what people think. You know, we all have a moan and stuff and a whinge up when we're serving, but it is a brilliant organisation to feel part of. It is a belonging. You do feel wanted. You can achieve some great things if you really want to achieve some good things within the military. You've got that brotherhood, sisterhood. You know, if you're a female, you've got this incredible bond. And then, yeah, to kind of step away from that organisation, you're then on your own, you're isolated, you lose your identity, you know. I was pretty well known within the regiment, whether it for the right or wrong reasons, you know, only they would say, but all of a sudden now you're away from it all. No one understands about war fighting really, unless you're a soldier. A strict regime, a disciplined regime, core values. You know, a lot of businesses do have them, but they're nowhere near as rigid and as tight and as structured as the military. So that's a shock in itself. And having people to bounce off as well, because that's what we do in the military. You grow up working as a team, and that kind of becomes, you know, the base for what you go on to achieve. Nothing's ever done as an individual. It's always done bouncing off people and working together. And that's done from the minute you...
I mean, especially in the infantry.
Yeah.
Because you were just, it was tight, you were there.
Of course.
Continuously together.
You walked through the gates at 16 and 9 months with my sausage bag on my shoulder. And I was with, you know, 30 to 40 other young, scared boys, you know, ready to become men. And that doesn't fade. That is kind of consistent all the way through the military. So the transition is difficult. It's hard. It's kind of trying to hang on to what has been taught to you, because you're honestly such a big asset out in Civvy Street. But it's just kind of, you know, figuring out what is your strength, what is your weaknesses, being resilient on pushbacks and knockbacks, and figuring out, you know, not giving up and,
Well, yeah, we'll get to there, I think.
Yeah.
And the when did you buy your house?
Cool, I bought my house when I was young, you know. I was lucky enough to have, you know, my wife's parents, my parents preaching. And so I think I was like 25 when I bought my first house on a terraced, and then I just kind of crept up the ladder. So I was sensible in that aspect. So when everyone was going to like Falaraki and Ibiza and Magaluf, I was in the line skin.
Yeah.
But now, you
grouting.
Know, yeah. But now look, you know, I look at what we've got.
Yeah.
And it's paid its purpose. So,
well, already when you're talking about leaving then, just to have the house, because when I left, I wasn't leaving until I had an house. I was 21 when I bought my house.
Yeah.
Luckily, because it's in, you know, kind of in London.
Yeah.
I was so fortunate to do that. But the amount of guys who I know who left without a house, and it's all there, isn't it, for you to do that? Like, yeah. It's tricky. It is tricky to buy, of course, especially down south and some places up north now. But the, and going from the house then to resettlement, was that obvious choices.
Yeah, before we go on to that, was that a humble brag about having your house in London?
No, mate. I was really lucky.
No, years ago.
It was so fortunate. But I had people preaching.
Yeah, of course.
To me as well. And you've got to do it.
And if one bit of advice from this podcast would be, if you've got a bit of savings, really try and go on that ladder. Even if you need a bit of help, I know that there's help to buy schemes and stuff. You just need to get a foothold on the ladder, because it's the best thing that I had ever done. And it's some great advice that I had from people who I trusted.
Resettlement?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, I was terrible at resettlement, if I'm honest. I just did what probably 98% of the almost soldiers, especially the infantry soldiers, is go on back onto what I was used to. And that's the close protection circuit. So I was no different. I went and done my CP course of control risks. It was actually a good course, really good instructors, great banter. And then I left the course and went on a 9-week rotation. But I knew that I wasn't going to stay in that game for a long period of time, and I wasn't going to be kind of on that hook. I had my house, I was financially stable. That for me was just a little bit of extra money to kind of sort of let me have that buffer to only do one 9-week rotation. And on that rotation, I went back out to Iraq, and I was in northern Iraq, Erbil, which is completely different. And it really was. You know, I was out running in the streets. I was going to restaurants and having food. It's quite up and coming. Those who know Erbil will agree it was really up and coming. It was like a small Dubai back in the day when that was kind of up and coming. It really was. It was a really nice, beautiful place, if I'm honest. Safe. So it was slipper city, but it was paying well. I was on $450 a day, which was quite good money still for what we were doing anyway. Just transiting Americans and a few diplomats out to the oil rigs and just basically stagging on until they're finished. But yeah, like I said, that I'd just done one rotation on that, and I was offered an incredible opportunity from my former CEO, actually, Matt Mayer, who was and still is, looks after Canary Wharf and Canary Wharf Estates. There was an opportunity for the regiment to find someone to come into their benevolent fund organisation and kind of be chief fundraiser, head of events, and basically get this benevolent fund off the ground. We spoke on the phone. He said it's a blank bit of paper, and it can go or can be directed any way that I see fit. And he kind of gave me the free range to go and do this. I had a lot of connections anyway. I've got some close people who I knew would have helped me, and I went and asked the questions. When I agreed to do it, I then kind of went and seen these people who I trust, who are loyal, who are mentors to me as well, and just said, look, this is what I'm going to do. I know it's hard yards. Fundraising is graft. It really is. But I knew I could make a difference. I'm passionate about helping. Still fundraise. You know, we've got one coming up, a big event coming up shortly on the 1st through to the 2nd of July. So I'm forever giving back, and I think it's important to as well. So yeah, took that job on. It was full time, and it also kept my hand back in with the regiment, which was great. Attending, you know, Armed Forces Day, attending, you know, some of the air shows. It was a great chapter in my life.
What was the mission statement? What was the kind of vision of the benevolent fund?
It is what it is now. It's to help service and former service personnel, and also to help their families. So if someone, you know, falls on some hard times, can't pay your bills, you know, there's that regimental family. It's predominantly the Tigers family and their forebears to look after that close. It's a small charity, but within a small charity, you know exactly where their money's going.
So when there's a need?
Yeah, of course. It's like most charities. When there's a need, some people will reach out for help, or people reach out for help, and then it's case by case. It's examined, clearly.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of a grant then given to whoever has applied for that grant to help.
Mm. You mentioned family there. Just want to touch on something. When you went through resettlement, I'm kind of going back a little bit.
Yeah.
Did Lucy transition well?
Didn't ask her.
Right.
It's bad, really. And there's a lot of things I never asked Lucy. And I just kind of, you know, I was transitioning. She was with me. Therefore, she just got on with it. And it's very selfish, I know. But I was the main breadwinner. So there's a lot of pressure on my shoulders, especially coming from that military timeline. I was quite a senior colour sergeant at the time.
Mm.
And then in a like flip of a coin, all of a sudden I've signed off and I'm getting out. So there's a lot of pressure on my shoulders. We've got a mortgage that has to be paid. So I kind of just got my head down and got on with it. And Lucy, you kind of reintegrated into our home village. She knows a lot of people. Her mum and dad were close, so that kind of made things a little bit easier. But did I ask her, or did I monitor her and transition? No, I never did.
Mm. Did she get work, or was she with the kids when she first
went? She went back to work part-time. And so she could still take the kids and pick the kids up from school.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's worth thinking about, isn't it? I hear it again, time and time again, exactly what you just said then. And people don't take into that consideration, but actually, especially my mates who've transitioned really well and then just literally bridged across, which like most people do, they transition and they bridge and then they go up. That successful transition of the partner as well, or the wife or the husband, is really important, and we should be taking that into consideration as well. So we on to the PWR Benevolent Fund.
Yeah.
How long was you there for?
Just over a year and a half.
And what was you doing? Was you like the CEO? What was your role there?
Yeah, I kind of overseen it. Yeah, I mean, I had some Nick Goble, who is a mentor and continues to be a mentor for me. He also was the co-founder along with Matt Mayer.
Right.
So they were co-founders. They had a very busy, demanding job. They needed someone to take the bull by the horn and really get this up to a credible status. They looked at me and asked me if I would do that. I did it. I kind of, you know, I like to think I was successful. Raised an incredible amount of money for the Benevolent Fund. We changed people's lives through that, whether it be the awareness or raising enough money to send people off for pioneering surgery. And whether it be recarpeting someone's house or paying someone's mortgage, I mean, we were a success. But I still had ambition, because I was 35 at the time. I was just working in the middle of London. And but to be fair to Matt Mayer, always said to me, at least just do it for a year, because the amount of contacts you'll make will be worth it. So he always pushed me to kind of be the best version of myself, if I'm honest. And he was like that as a CEO when I operated under him in 2004. He always got the best out of people. But he knew, being on that platform, there would be opportunities which would come up.
Mm. The with regards to kind of mentorship, and especially people you could trust and rely on, was that an integral part of it, was it? Because it sounds like you went into then like a very operational role, trying to raise a lot of funds, but also getting that guidance about like networking.
Yeah.
And that is a real, if I can't explain it enough, you've got to be around people that, one, share the same kind of values as you do, but also like share the kind of same work ethic, or, you know, no one's ever going to give you anything. You've got to go out there and build relationships. So to get kind of snippets of information like that, where you've got to go network, you've got to go meet people, you've got to build, you know, like I said, those relationships.
Yeah.
Was that mentoring important?
It was important, and it still is important. And I'm never too proud to ask for help or some direction, even now. And it's so important. So like the first day I took the role on, I went to see Sir Lloyd Dorfman, who's a powerhouse globally, overly successful individual, went and seen him in Manchester Square, went into his office, and it's quite an intimidating office to be in. And this individual has been there, done it, and been very successful. But I've got a great relationship because I worked with him solid for a year when I actually got out the first time, and we maintained that trust in that bubble. So I went to him because he's a mentor. I speak about him in my book also, about what he's done for me. And I said, look, this is the role I've taken on. He said, be under no illusion, it's a difficult role. You know, bearing in mind he's chaired the Prince's Trust. He's done the Jewish community and what he's done for their fundraising, what he's done with a Great Ormond Street. They've got a wing named after him, Sir Lloyd Dorfman's wing. So the guy, you know, has given millions and millions to charity, but understands it's a difficult role because of raising funds is hard. And we spoke about it for a long period of time. And then he gave me a starting donation.
Okay.
On kind of my second day, which was just, it just goes to show the individual who he is. You know, we were doing this Spinnaker Tower event, abseiling off the Spinnaker Tower, and he said, look, to start you off, there you go, there's a check. So yeah, that relationship and him as a mentor, it continues to this day.
But people will see that as like you've just been handed a check, when in fact that relationship goes back ten years.
Of course, it's a backstory to everything, Michael.
Building a relationship, building trust, and the integrity piece that we often talk about.
I worked hard for him.
Yeah,
you know, I've worked all hours God sends to help him and the family out, and he knows that. So we maintained that trust when he was awarded, you know, his CBE from the Queen. I congratulated him even though I was away, and you know, it's just kind of keeping your presence.
It's your touch points.
Yeah,
you know, you need to be keeping on
top.
And it's the right thing to do, of course,
we've just got a good relationship, and we've continued that, and I'm actually speaking to the Royal Ballet in Covent Garden. He's asked me to do that, so that'll be interesting.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
You were a very good dancer.
I can never dance. Don't you over that.
You went on to work at the office group after that. And that role was, again, full on, wasn't it? And it has been to kind of this day, really. They've been really supportive of you over the years.
Yeah.
Was it always like that when you went into to TOG?
I can't speak highly enough of the boys at TOG. There's three of them, really. The two co-CEOs, Ollie and Charlie, are just, they're like the ant in deck, but of the flexible workspace. They just are nailing it. They're so good. Even when they do get up and deliver talks and stuff to the business, they just, you can see why they've worked and you can see why they've dominated their space, and they continue to do so. They're just brilliant. And they took a massive chance on me, because I wasn't educated, didn't understand the property world, the flexible workspace. But I met them through Lloyd. We actually done an away weekend in Cyprus. I took a crew out, believe it or not, on Lloyd's private jet, and that's not a humble brag. I just couldn't even believe I was on a private jet. But we flew to Cyprus, and we spent a long weekend with our 2nd Battalion going through leadership, weaponry, took them on the ranges. So it was a real good eye-opener for them to kind of bring them into my world. And they really respected that. So, yeah, then we just got on really well. And they said, look, you should come over. Go to the kind of the back end of the operations. You can, you know, lead. You understand the structure, timelines. And it was just kind of doing the basics right, and it seemed to work. And when everything kind of kicked off and what happened with my story and stuff like that, they've just been so supportive, got right behind me and give me the time and space to actually grab this opportunity, which I'm just going with now. So I can't praise them enough, and the business, the culture that they've created, the work ethic that is within the office group, it's down to them. you know, like I said, Ollie, Charlie, and then my kind of direct boss is Warren, and what a guy he is. Just gets it, understands me, which is only a few people do, because I'm from a different kind of breed, being in the military, but they're that good. Like, my old platoon commander now works for the office group, so they've taken that faith with veterans, and because they get repaid. We're very, you know, I'm not saying everyone in the military or former serving is overly loyal and works hard, because there's a percentage that don't. We know that. It's like any organisation, but a lot of them do. And Jake, my old, one of the old, all former officers in B Company, he now is head of information security. So the cyber stuff, which is a huge job, huge task, and he's gone in there and made a name for himself already. So they're believing in giving veterans a chance, which is brilliant.
Well, I think you look at things like, and I don't buy into this clean shaven and haircut and on time thing. I think that massively undersells everyone. And I see it on CVs where,
The thing is, I would debate you on times. Times are so important.
They are important. No, but what I'm saying is, that is just like a base level. I would expect that off everyone, but there is obviously integrity and the honesty of about that. That's like kind of a base level stuff, where is we sell ourselves short by just saying things like that, where we should be talking about things like values, things like operations, like literally operational, an ops director or whatever, all these other skills that we've developed, like drive and tenacity and problem solving, like at a really, really high level. And that's what's come in here, because we've overviewed it really quick then, but you was working really hard, you was travelling, over an hour and a half every day to get into work and back again. Mm-hmm. So you got a busy family life as well. And this was way before, the book or especially appearing on TV or any of the public speaking. But companies do need almost permission, or do need that kind of push to give, the veterans a chance. But it is repaid, and I see it all the time.
Oh, it's repaid, honestly. And I'm not saying it from me and what I've done for TOG, and hopefully I've added value to the group. And but only they would answer that question. But I'm passionate about helping veterans. I wouldn't even say have a second chance. I would just say give them that time and be patient with their
bit of patience.
Patience with their transition, because they were the office group were patient with me. I was a round hole, massive square peg at the beginning. I was like, what is going on here? Completely different culture shock, really. But they knew that. They give me a bit of time, where a lot of organisations don't. They're like, nah, you're not working. Just give it a bit of time. Let him figure it out, because he's it's just having that overview and that common sense that he's been in a different world for a long time, and now just give him a little bit of chance to find his feet. And if it doesn't work, 9 times out of 10, the individual put his hand up and say, or her hand up and say, actually, it's not for me.
And just while you were speaking then about kind of veteran-owned businesses and why it's becoming more and more popular, and I am certainly seeing it more and more, these small businesses that are opening up, because everything you just said then about giving the chance, well, actually, just take the chance yourself, figure things out, figure the piece of software that you need, figure the contact that you need out, figure the industry you want to go in, be vision-led instead of cash-driven. Find someone if you want to work with
someone. Believe in your product.
Yeah.
And find someone who understands and gets it as much as you do, and then you will make it work.
Well, you look at us, just come off the phone with him. We look at Sean. So Sean Jones, he I can't believe I'm going to say this. Right, but I definitely should be paying him more, but I run a small business. Like he should be on a lot more, but he believes what I believe in.
Yeah.
He believes what we're all about and believes what we're going forward. And I've got like an unbelievable person with me because we share the same kind of values and mindset.
Yeah, but he'll understand that. And if it wasn't working for him, you look at is he on the right pay scale? Probably not. But is he spending a lot more time with his family? He probably is. So he's got that work-life balance, incredible. And a lot of people don't have that. Yes, he's taking kind of a bit of a salary hit, but money can't compensate for what he's got at home. He's missed that last 10 years because he's been away with the military on operations or on exercises or doing whatever. So yeah, it kind of does find balance itself out, and I'm sure if he wasn't happy,
you know, we're going on to me now, but we're in it for the long game,
yeah,
as well, and like I said, we are creating
the bottom line is you can't put a price on family time.
Oh yeah, exactly. And just, you know what I mean, just again, believing in who you're with, believing in what you're trying to achieve. You know, that's why, like, having a vision or a mission statement, especially as a small business, or knowing what your values are. And then I've said this before on here, like, decision making becomes much easier then. If you know what your values are, if your value is to be honest and you do something dishonest, well, what's the point?
Yeah, it's
it just goes against everything,
yeah, of course,
that you stand for. And that's one thing, to my point, is that when people leave and we transition, like, values is such a big thing.
Yeah.
And we should be talking about it a lot more, especially in interview, if that's the way you're going, if you're setting business up, if that's the way you're going, because aligning values, working with people who believe what you believe in, creates that team and creates a good relationship. This is episode one. We did episode one of Declassified and on your book, Double Cross, that's all out there. But before all of that, the extremely well documented court case went through, and then you got invited on to Good Morning Britain. Was that like kind of a start of something else?
I think it was, because it was the first time that people heard the story from the horse's mouth. And I always say this as well, it wasn't me as an individual what went through the inquiry, what went through the kind of the 10 years of graft to kind of clear our names. It was me plus many more, the regiment, the British Army. His name was tarnished. But I wanted to do something about it, Michael. I wanted to let the people know, the great British public, that the military and my regiment and me and soldiers on the ground didn't do what the allegations were saying that we did do. I wanted them to hear how disappointed I was for the MOD, the government, allowing a shyster to breach and to take advantage of human life for soldiers doing their job on the ground. And I wanted to let people know that it wasn't fair for us to be taken, you know, especially for such a long period of time, through the mill like that. It was unfair with the lack of support that we got. Zero. No support. So I was passionate about voicing that. I got an opportunity, I went on, and then things escalated from there.
Mm. So from there, then you got, then off the back of that, so you took the opportunity.
Yeah.
You weren't getting paid for that. It was just, you wanted to like you said, to voice what the reality of it. Then you started getting asked to speak publicly for free.
Yeah.
So people just get in touch. And what kind of stuff was you doing at that point? Was you just getting out and telling your story?
Well, a lot of people were interested in the narrative.
Yeah.
But from the narrative, there's so many sub pillars, whether it be leadership, whether it be decision making, mental health, mental fitness.
Mm.
There was resilience, mindset. So there's so many sub pillars. People wanted to kind of galvanize into that as well. And then a few inquiries I got were, can you keynote on leadership and kind of extract a few things from your real life on operations? So yeah, I would kind of go and do that. Mm. But like I said, I started off doing it and giving my time because I was passionate about what I was doing. I wanted to keep that kind of rhythm up on letting people know what actually did happen, but people enjoyed it.
Mm.
And they took, it wasn't just inspirational, I'd like to think they actually took some key pointers away that they can implement in business.
Mm.
You know, so it seemed to be going really well, and it just kind of, it's been growing organically since. And
but I mean, you spoke hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And before any money was crossed palms, you were speaking and speaking and speaking and speaking at different events. For
but I think it's like anything that you do, Mike, and you'll know this. It's there's you've got to give free content away to see, one, does it work? What's the feedback that I'm getting? Because if I'm terrible, then I'm not going to continue. Are people actually taking life lessons away from what I'm doing? And if that's happening and you're getting inundated with requests, there's a value to that. So with a value comes financial, because it's your time, it's your emotional journey, it's your experiences. So therefore, you should be credited for that. And it's figuring out a price on that and going out and try not to undersell yourself. And it's difficult. I mean, I still find it really hard now and really tough when I get asked the blunt questions, like on the phone or via email. It's a hard thing because I've never had to do it ever before, and all of a sudden I'm getting these big questions fronted up at me, and I'll get it wrong still, but I'm learning, because everything's a learning process, and I'm still learning now.
And you know, just on the speaking side of things as well, like off the back, you can start, like you said, like you figure out that that's working there, that's not quite working, that, and then you start crafting it, and it is a skill, and it's not like you're in Brecon briefing 30 squaddies, right? You can't speak like that in corporate.
You need to know your audience. It's really important, because I've done something like, you know, Santander chief executives. These are like overly intelligent people. I'm going to, you know, American Express in 2 weeks' time to speak to their executives. I went to speak to Brighton Football Club. That was meant to be a day. It lasted for 3 days. You know, county cricket teams. You know, these are elite athletes or elite business people. And you can't just talk how you would normally talk to in the military lingo and the military language. But like you said, it's tapering it. It's figuring out what's good, what's not. It's knowing your audience. And hey, listen, and I'm talking as if I'm like a well-oiled machine, and I'm not. I have done a lot of speaking at the moment. I've just recently come back from, flew out to New York and boarded Cunard, Queen Mary 2, and spoke in front of over 800 guests there, and that was an incredible experience. And like I said, and on to the next couple of weeks, I'm off to speak to American Express and then off to Guernsey. So it has been a busy period, but I'm not fine-tuned.
But you get in there. But
yeah,
I think so. Like you said, if you hadn't put yourself in the position, and sometimes it's scary to put yourselves in that position as well, especially when, and I know the one that was really kind of daunting for you was the one when you flew out to Cyprus.
Cyprus is hard because, you know, I went to speak to two fighting regiments, the Royal Anglians, which have got an incredible history, and two Mercians, which have also battle-hardened. And I was going out there to kind of share my story, but more on the kind of mental health piece and the wellness and the fitness and the growth. And you and I speak about that growth, and maybe, you know, that I would say in a few years' time, it will come a famous quote about the growth generation, because now a lot of people and big hitters are using it, and actually came from Michael. So that was a tough gig, but it was probably one of the better feedback that I've done, which was incredible. And it was really nerve-wracking, having a fireside conversation in the warrant officers and sergeants mess with the warrant with the officers being invited in. You know, that's a big audience. But for me, it was staying true to myself, being honest, and just not patronising anyone about war stories, because we've all got our own individual war stories. It's actually what affected me, how it affected me, how I extinguished to a degree some of the effects, how I gained to cope with how I was feeling, and by that meaning seeking some professional support and then growing from that to where I am now, standing on one of the most famous ships in the world, being Queen Mary 2, and sharing my story with some Vietnam veterans, some World War 2 veterans, and the evasion that I got, it makes it all worth it.
No, mate, it's so good. And I remember you coming back from Cyprus and you being totally buzzing about it.
Yeah,
scared before, and then the elation of. I think it was the more that you connected with people.
Yeah.
And you didn't not bore people, But you felt like you were almost going to disrespect someone.
I didn't want to patronise anyone. Yeah. They're like, oh, sit down, Woody. I mean, we've been there and done it. It wasn't like that. And what the CO said, if he actually made a great point and said, look, we've got people within this organisation, within this mess, who have got a similar story to Woody, but haven't been brave enough to come out and voice they've had some trouble. They've had some real time through adversity with mental health, but actually he's come out and he spoke about it. He's been public with how he felt through these times, and we need more people like that. And some of the conversations I had after, and also the messages that I had from some really senior warrant officers, it made it all worthwhile.
We touched on mental health there. You know, we can have poor mental health, we can have good mental health, just like physical health as well. And I know them two battalions were doing a lot to promote the management of good mental health and mental resilience and mental fitness, and which is great to see. And then, but now, like, day to day, because there's a lot of pressure on you, like there is, and especially when we're in our 30s, you've got kids and a mortgage, you know, things can start like stacking up, and we need to kind of keep the bucket offloading just day to day, whether that's going for a run or whether it's, you know, getting a cold shower or spending time with the kids or the family or your mates. What do you do day to day? Because you've got a hectic life.
Yeah. I always set an hour aside in the day, whether it be first thing in the morning or in the evening, and I go running. I know that you swim. For me, running is kind of my escape. I think of all sorts of random stuff when I'm running, you know, and by the time I get back home, I'm thinking, bloody hell, I've just done 6 miles. And I'm just, my head's clear. And if I don't, I become agitated. I'm like, I should be running, or, you know, so there's always time to kind of make for your physical fitness. And I think it's so important to make time and to get something. Running might not be for everyone, but there's something for everyone, and it's finding what works for you. But it's very important. And like I say, running for me, I don't even like running, you know, hate it. But what it does for my headspace is incredible. It hurts. It doesn't get any easier. I'm blowing out my, you know, my back station, and I'm like, this just, but it's so good for me.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for suffering a little bit as well, as in like short-term suffering, whether you don't like something. Because if we're talking to a small business owner or a big business owner or an individual who's running a busy household or, you know, working in a high-pressure job or not quite knowing where they are, to still have the mindset and the foresight to suffer a little bit, whether it's going to do some hill reps, whether it's going to do, a CrossFit session or going to do a long swim, and just put yourself in an uncomfortable situation for a small amount of time. Because, again, like running a small business, you can be like as high as a kite 1 minute, and quite literally an hour later, the VAT bill comes in. And then you figure and you pay the VAT bill, and then you come out the top of it, and something great's happened, then you're back down, and then you're up and down. And the trick is to try and level it. And for me, right, so I'm giving you a bit of my insight, is, it's going to be a little roller coaster up and down, but you keep the level ground, keep that kind of, that mainstay, you know, bring yourself, or know what to do to bring yourself back in. And with things like trauma injury, can be trickier, obviously, with, you know, you've got to have a toolbox that you can go in and bring yourself back. But just day to day, like you said, if it's a run, like the suffering helps. Whether it's a cold shower, the suffering
helps.
And it's
always nice to go into the pain chamber sometimes. You know, I'm going into it, like I said, on the first, we're doing this charity 24 hours, 24 participants and 24 exercises. And I haven't trained for that. I mean, who trains to do 24 hours worth of fitness? I don't think a lot of people. So that's going to, I'll be visiting some dark times, no doubt there. But you just got to keep hold of the purpose and remind yourself why you're doing it, because there is soldiers, still out there. There's veterans still out there who are suffering, and we need to kind of maintain the awareness, keep the, you know, the donations coming in to help these, yeah, to help these people, because they are going through a hard time in their life, and yeah, we should do as much as we can to support that.
The and that can come in the form of employment and opportunity as well, because there's a lot of high functioning people that are suffering as well. And understandably, if you've got 15 years of war fighting and then everything before that as well, I'm not disregarding anyone else, but you know, look at your battalion, right?
So
like, I would probably say right up there with the most time spent kind of really on it.
Yeah.
And understandably, it's going to be trauma injury. So, but again, people who are really competent, who are managing to keep that mainstay, but then, you know, going to seek professional help and guidance and listening to stuff like Declassified, or listening to this podcast or whatever it is, or speaking to a mate. Coming off the back of all of this then, we're looking at things, you know, your future's looking really bright. Like, we're not going to talk too much about the long-term stuff, but there's going to have to be a time where you're going to have to make some really important decisions for yourself and your family. But there's also other opportunities that have come off the back, like ambassadorial roles, which is also going into like paid ambassadorial, and there's other opportunities that even like me and yourself are going into now. And it's exciting, but it doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen without a struggle.
People sometimes think it does, though, and you can't control that, though. This is, I would like to think, down to hard work. It's people, I would like to think, aren't stupid. They know who kind of will fit their brand and who kind of will align themselves with going back to our values and that what their values stand for. And have I had some opportunities come up? I have. Have I turned down some opportunities? I have as well, because it hasn't aligned, you know. And there's a big sort of mainstream channel production company what wanted me on their show. And I turned that down because it didn't align. The money was there, the money was good, but it didn't align with my brand and who I was. And it's sometimes it's nice to turn things down as well. So, you know, I have been in front of some good opportunities. I have taken some opportunities on the ambassadorial roles. You know, with Bremont have been brilliant with me. Incredible watch company co-owned by Nick and Giles. They've just been incredible to me. Thrifty, you know, the rental, got an incredible partnership with them. I'm showcasing, you know, a car each month, and it's a, you know, top of the range cars as well. And I actually kind of twisted their arm on a discount code for veterans, and now they've done that to kind of promote. So we're going into Pathfinder magazine, Thrifty are, through a conversation that I had, because they should be supporting the armed forces. And they are now. And we're going into having conversations with Soldier Magazine. My discount code's Brian19. So you should. It's a flexible fleet. And I don't get any commission, trust me. They've just really helped me and partnered with me on my book tour. And kind of, they're just, they really like supporting.
Yeah, even like Bremont, like they do so much for the military community.
So much.
Like, and they do it with a real kind of subtle leverage as well.
Yeah.
It's not vulgar the way they do their ambassador stuff. Like, it really is family orientated.
Yeah. And it's through a friend of mine. You know, this came from a good friend of mine who I went to school with. And I then met the managing director at a hotel for a coffee. I wouldn't say bullied him into supporting the military, just told him my backstory, what we're about, and what he should think about doing. And then he called me and said, right, we're going to do something for the military. And I really want to do it, want to help. So
that's Thrifty?
Yeah, it's Martin, Cars. Who's the MD.
So they're signing the Armed Forces Covenant, or have they done that?
They're going, well, they're next year they're planning to go up and get amongst all that. Because the thing is, it's only just been since they've looked and partnered with me on actually the community is a special community, and they should help out. And I mean, it's going in the right direction.
So, well, being an example is, and this is what this is an example of.
Yeah.
But being that role model, and you don't set out to be a role model, but inadvertently that's what you become. Whether it's someone reaching out to you on social media and saying, oh, why didn't you post on this day, or why didn't you post on that day, or why can't you do this? And you getting pushed and pulled around.
Yeah.
Because people want a piece. Like, it doesn't just fall. It takes time.
And don't get me wrong, it has been a learning curve, because I've never been, and I'm still not a subject matter expert on social media, and I do get these requests. I do ask people do ask me to post and to do X, Y, and Z timings and stuff. So I'm trying to kind of find a fine balance myself. But, you know, I've just got to be as well, remember who I am, be true to myself. And, like, I'm too old, I think, in the tooth, kind of not to understand who I am now. So,
yeah,
it's a great journey. And then, obviously, a lot of people will know Hillary Meredith. She's the solicitor who really support the armed forces. I mean, she's been campaigning for years and
that's
years.
That's Hillary Meredith.
Yeah.
Solicitors, yeah.
Yeah, and she's been campaigning for years on helping soldiers and helping soldiers' families with, whether it be helping them with injuries, with claims, and, you know,
the compensation scheme, which has been a big thing.
Compensation, which has been huge. And also kind of the Al Sweedy stuff has been a great shoulder for me to kind of lean on and kind of back and forth and have some conversations on a kind of legal spin on things. So she's been an incredible, I would say, an ambassador for the military community. So to kind of go in as an ambassador for her firm most recently is a... I'm privileged to do that, because we're going back to her values, align with mine, and it's going to be a great little partnership and journey.
Yeah, mate, I think the look, you summarise this episode, you look at values, you look at staying true to what you believe in, and surrounding yourself with great people, but also, like, willing to speak to new people as well. But relationships take time.
Of course.
And even whether that's on social media or whether that's meeting someone at a dinner party, right? These things, do you go to dinner parties? You know what I mean? Drinks. And but these things do take time. You don't jump into bed with people straight away. Like, it takes time to forge that relationship. Mate, I really do always appreciate your time. I enjoy spending time with you. I know you love,
like-minded
absolutely love
people.
Spending time with me. And we will leave it there.